This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Journalism is sometimes called the first draft of history. After all, journalists tell stories as they're happening or shortly after. The Dakota Journalist Podcast is taking that idea a step further by gathering oral history and analysis from veteran print journalists. The newspaper associations of both North and South Dakota teamed up to sponsor the podcast, and today we'll share an episode that examines the challenges from the 1940s to the present for women journalists. The podcast is hosted by Terry Finneman, an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. We pick it up with longtime Grand Forks Herald columnist Marilyn Haggerty, whose story begins at the University of South Dakota during World War II.
Well, it was during World War II, of course, so it was a very strange time on the campus. There were something like 70 men on campus and about 400 women. Women did everything because there were no men. I mean, it was clear sailing that there were two women were editors of the Volant, the school paper, and I got in line. I was the assistant managing editor, so that when I became a senior, I was editor of the school newspaper. I worked in the journalism department, and the journalism professor, E.G. Trotsik, was, to me, he was wonderful. And he encouraged me and helped me. When we were sophomores, the men started coming back. We stood in line, watched them on the campus, standing in line to sign up for the GI Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. There were rows and rows of people when we were sophomores. So my junior and senior year, there was, you know, a normal college year. And things were sort of, you know, getting back to pre-war years.
The war provided new opportunities, not just for Haggerty, but for women across the nation, who stepped in to fill roles normally dominated by men. But when the war ended, women were relegated back to their dominant roles as housewives. Haggerty describes what expectations were like for women at the time.
Pretty pathetic. It was, when I was growing up, we're sort of supposed to know your own place, and if you went to college, if you didn't find a husband by the time you graduated, people sort of wondered what was wrong with that handsome girl. She's senior at South Dakota, and she's not engaged. It was sort of like you'd go to college to meet a husband, I think. And not everyone, but many women did that, and that was what was the norm. When you did graduate, as I did from South Dakota in journalism, when you went to take on a job, my first job was Aberdeen American News. That summer they hired three new reporters. One was from the University of Missouri, Eddie Tollefson, and he thought he was hot stuff because he came from Missouri, and the other was Bob something, who had graduated from South Dakota State, and me from Vermilion, the university. So the managing editor went to put out the assignments, and he gave Eddie the police beat, which was pretty good. And he gave the guy from South Dakota State the area beat. You know, he'd travel and visit farms, agriculture, and he was good at that. And guess what he gave me? I could be assistant to an old lady named Florence Delaney, who was the society editor. I could be the assistant. And I just sat there seething. And as soon as he was through with us, I went into his office and I said, I didn't go to college 4 years to be an assistant to Edith Delaney. She's had no formal education. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, I'll see that you get better assignments. And he was good. He understood. But he said, but when she's on vacation, you are going to have to take her place. And I said, well, you know, that I could see, but I couldn't see just being her assistant after working all that time in South Dakota. So Leif Johnson, the managing editor, has had me doing features, which I love to do. And he liked my features, and the publisher did, so they pretty much put me on that type of story, although I had the hospital beat and the school board. And, you know, I liked that all right, but it was pretty clear that when if you were a woman, you were not ever to have designs on being managing editor or anything like that. You could just have some minor job.
In the 1960s, Hagerty joined the newspaper where she's worked ever since, the Grand Forks Herald, where her husband Jack worked as managing editor. There were few women in the newsroom at the time.
One or two at the most. There were women working at the Grand Forks Herald. There were quite a few in the business offices and the different parts of the newspaper, but in the editorial department, there were women on the switchboard, and there would be like one or possibly two women reporters most of the time. I remember the 60s and into the 70s at the Herald. The ones who did what they used to call society, and then it became lifestyle, they would usually be women, one older and one age. Women reporters were, even during those times, hard to find because my husband seeking out, trying to find people, that I don't think there were as many people going into journalism then. Because journalism was mostly you'd think of as newspapers, and it was just becoming the broader field of writing for television, and so it was opening up, and around the country you were hearing more and more of women leading the way in journalism jobs.
There were mixed reactions to women reporters, but Hagerty felt welcome, at least among her male co-workers.
I felt that they treated us quite well. I felt that they were supportive, probably more so than the people we interviewed or the people who did not know a lot about the newspaper, because when we'd come as a woman reporter, sometimes people who considered themselves quite important would wonder why the newspaper would send a woman to interview them.
The same trend was occurring at newspapers across the country. In South Dakota, Mary Carol Keeter also saw issues for women journalists.
I think the other journalists, I think, in my experience, always treated the women the same as their men friends. Some sources, though, did not. I mean, there still are some people, politicians, public officials, businessmen, who are very patronizing to women in general, and particularly in journalism. I mean, there's still not a completely level playing field there. I think that's societal. I don't think that's against journalism. You know, I don't think it's a particular offense occurring only to women in journalism, but it does still exist in the world.
You're listening to Main Street, and today we're airing an episode of the Dakota Journalists Podcast, which preserves the oral histories of newspaper journalists across North and South Dakota. After the break, we'll hear how attitudes changed as women entered what had been a male-dominated profession.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Bismarck Land and Mineral Rights Attorney Fintan Dooley. He's with the Salted Lands Council, and we'll have a musical performance from Darian Lee next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and today an episode from the Dakota Journalist Podcast examines sexism in the newspaper industry and the changing work environment. Jack Marsh has worked at newspapers across the country, most recently in South Dakota, and he says men received many advantages not afforded to women.
Until the mid-1960s, women were pretty much limited to what they called the society or social page. And that eventually evolved into like the family pages and eventually a lifestyle section. But most women in newsrooms were either in support roles, they were fetching coffee, or they were called copy girls sometimes. They'd be doing odd jobs in the newsroom. Well, it was very, like society, it was, very sexist early on. Women were discriminated against. They weren't the only ones discriminated against. But when I started out, certainly as an intern, all of management and most of the reporters were men, not all, but most.
John Andrist, who ran a small weekly in northwestern North Dakota, admits that he was among those who initially treated women differently.
There may have been some salary discrimination years ago, but I know I was guilty of that. I remember visiting with another publisher talking shop at Rugby years ago, and he had a woman linotype operator, which was kind of unusual. Not very women, and many women were in the production part of newspapering, just a few. And I asked him what he had to pay. I don't know what her real name was, but her nickname was Freddie. And I said, "What do you have to pay Freddie?" He says, "I pay her $90 a week." I said, "Holy cow, that's as much as you pay a man." I remember saying it. I'm guilty. His reaction was, "Well, I tell you something about Freddie." He says, "The things got so bad, I can only afford one person. And it was me or Freddie, I'd leave myself." So he thought the world of Freddie. But as I say, without the female gender, I'd never produced a newspaper in the offset years.
In western North Dakota, Linda Seiler also struggled with respect after joining the Dickinson Press in 1970.
I didn't feel important. I felt I was just another secretary at first. We're talking at first. Margot, and then as we did stories and there was two of us out there, I think we started getting respect and respect for what we did, that we were writers, that they can trust us with stories. So it's been a gradual evolution from I wasn't respected, I didn't have any self-confidence, to the reporters come to me now and ask about a lead that they are stuck on or who they should get for somebody to interview. So I've come the whole spectrum. But then it was hard.
Seiler came of age during the second wave of feminism, which impacted her life goals.
I knew I wasn't going to be just a wife. I fought to drop the name Mrs. Tom Kuntz, and I was Linda Seiler. So it was the little things that I would fight for. I felt like I was a feminist, too, because I could compare where I wanted to go and who I wanted to be to my mom and her grandma, who were still in their dresses and their aprons. And I thought that was horrible. And so the rest of us in school, we revolted. We wore, it's a little thing, but we went from dresses to blue jeans. I refused to wear a dress in college. So that I think I was more of a feminist then because I wore what I wanted to be, and that was blue jeans. So it's the little things, and I was aware of it.
She was also aware of the unequal pay in the newsroom.
I felt like I was never paid nearly as much as some of the reporters. I can say that because you really shouldn't see somebody else's paycheck. And I realized that, dear God, some of these young reporters were getting paid as much as I or more. And that caused a lot of resentment. And I think it was because I was just a lifestyle reporter.
40 miles away in Hebron, North Dakota, Jane Brandt was working as publisher of the Hebron Herald. After her divorce in the early 1970s, she took on the trailblazing role around the same time that Katharine Graham gained prominence as publisher of the Washington Post. Like Graham, Brandt wasn't always taken seriously in those early days.
I was sitting at my desk one day, and a man came through the door, and he said, "Could I speak to the publisher?" And I said, "I'm the publisher." Oh, he said, "I'm looking for a job." And I said, "I'm the publisher," and he just turned on his heels and walked out the door. I mean, that's women, those traveling printers, they were not going to work for a woman. I just laughed because this woman's movement, it's never meant anything to me. I'm running a newspaper. That doesn't bother me. It just didn't mean a thing, but I just had a laugh at the fella.
For Native American women, however, just getting a foot in the door was an even bigger challenge. Tim Gallego, who has published Native newspapers in South Dakota, said opportunities were limited.
They worked for me. They worked for an Indian newspaper. I've had a couple of them that were extremely good writers, good journalists, that went to apply for work at some of the dailies in South Dakota and were never hired. So, in fact, I don't know of any of my writers that ever went on to work for a non-Indian newspaper, even though I thought they were some of the very high qualified journalists. So I really don't know the reasons behind that.
Mike Jacobs of the Grand Forks Herald made an effort to attend conference sessions for women journalists when he could.
I wanted to understand what their issues were and what their perspectives were and why they were different than mine. It's hard for men to get it, just as it's hard for white people to get it when it comes to race relations, as we're finding out.
Jacob said the industry has long struggled with addressing gender equity issues.
I think that the big issue in when I was coming up in the business was how do you create newspapers whose content is broadly reflective of the shared interests of men and women, and how do you integrate women, so to speak, into the larger newsroom, so that they are not just society reporters. And in some ways, I think we failed at that, because there's still a ghettoization of women in newsrooms, in education reporting and trend reporting, entertainment reporting. It's no longer, the content itself is no longer sectionalized, and women are no longer sort of slotted into society page roles. But there's still, I think, I don't have data to show this, but my experience is that they're still slotted into what you think of as women's interests.
Dale Blagan of the D. Smith News also reflected on the transition for women.
I don't know if you've ever seen any wedding stories from that era, but the stories that most of the society editors would write would go into extensive descriptions of the bride's dress and the bridesmaid's dresses and the bride's mother's dress and the groom's mother's dress and this kind of thing. Fairly lightweight stuff. And women staffers would also from time to time write feature stories, but usually the lighter, more human interest kinds of things. And as you well know, that has transitioned completely. Women are now publishers and executive editors and reporters who are doing investigative work, and you know, the environment today is totally different than it was then, where there would be two, maybe three women on a 12-person staff. My guess is now there's probably half or more will be women. So that has changed significantly.
The increase in women in newsrooms does make a difference, women journalists say.
I think women bring the perspective of writing as women. I mean, it's a different experience growing up as a man and growing up as a woman. Women only know women's experiences, men only know men's experiences, and so the advantage to the reader is that you're getting two different, and sometimes completely different, approaches to telling a story. So I think that's an advantage, and I think that's just reality.
I think they bring a little more warmth sometimes to some stories, and I think maybe a little more understanding about the person that they're interviewing. And I'm not knocking any men, because there are great male journalists. A softness, maybe, once in a while. Not all the time, but once in a while.
Thinking it's empathy, being able to listen to what you're doing and saying. I've seen plenty of editors consume the conversation doing something. They don't know when to shut up. Just and maybe share just a bit of your life. You don't have to, but sometimes it helps. But I think it's the empathy and ability to listen to what they're doing. Same. Keep your mouth shut.
Keeter thinks women in journalism have more opportunities now than ever before, but challenges remain.
Well, there's always room for improvement. I think there's probably the glass ceiling to the very top level jobs is probably still there in some, you know, some companies and some organizations. I know it is much improved from when I graduated from college, and I think the opportunities to do different kinds of journalism are so much broader. You know, you hardly ever heard of a woman being a sports writer back in the 70s, you know, and now women are national sports writers and national sports columnists.
From World War II to the present, journalists in the Dakotas have witnessed the evolution of women's rights and women's roles in American society. Change has been slow, but the perseverance of these generations of journalists paved the way for women in journalism today and for those into the future. For the Dakota Journalist Podcast, I'm Terry Finneman, with sound editing by Savannah Wakefield. And these are the stories of the heart of the community in the Heartland.
The Dakota Journalist Podcast is sponsored by the North Dakota Newspaper Association and the South Dakota Newspaper Association. The host is Terry Finneman. Beginning Friday, it will be available on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, and Podbean apps. Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media reports on foreign ownership of U.S. farmland. Sue Balcom joins us for another Main Street Eats, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do at the beginning of June. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Joshua Wynn, Vice President for Health Affairs and Dean of the University of North Dakota's School of Medicine and Health Sciences, has been named the interim president for the University of North Dakota following a 9-0 vote in favor of his appointment by the State Board of Higher Education. Here's Prairie Public's Matt Eatson with that story.
After serving as the dean of the UND Medical School for 10 years, Joshua Wynn has agreed to take on the additional role of UND's interim president following the departure of the university's current president, Mark Kennedy, whose final day is June 15. Wynn plans to build on the current goals already set in place at the university. Praising the strategic plan implemented by Kennedy, Wynn encompassed his goals by saying he plans to keep moving forward and striving for excellence.
The strategic plan is widely, highly regarded. So fully implementing that will be a priority. Continuing the improvement in graduation rates and retention rates will be a priority. Beautifying the campus, dealing with deferred maintenance, those are examples of things that are already in play.
When asked how he plans to balance the two positions at once, Wynn said he'll be asking his senior leadership, who he says he relies on tremendously, to step up and assist in the workload. Additionally, Wynn, a practicing cardiologist, says he will cut down on his clinical activities to allow for more time. Rumors were circulating that Wynn's consideration was partially based on the assumption that he was nearing retirement for his current position, the idea being that Wynn could step down from his duties as dean of the medical school, serve as interim president as needed, and then retire. When asked if this was true, Wynn made it clear that was not the case.
It is not. Retirement is not a word that I use in my vocabulary. And in fact, I am going to continue in the vice president and dean role. And when the interim position is done, I will return to that full time.
Wynn is expected to begin his duties as the interim president shortly after the departure of Kennedy on June 15. Reporting for Prairie Public, I'm Matt Eatson.
And outgoing UND President Mark Kennedy says Joshua Wynn is an excellent choice to be the university's interim president. The Board of Higher Education named Wynn to take over when Kennedy leaves for Colorado next month. Kennedy says he believes Wynn will continue the progress made since UND started implementing its strategic plan.
Josh has been there from the beginning in creating it as a member of the executive committee with me and the other team. So he's going to provide that continuity. But he's also running a great college. Our college, our School of Medical Medicine and Health Sciences, is a fabulous part of the university. And he's shown great leadership there that I think is well respected across the state, across the nation, and we look forward to him providing that same leadership for the overall university during this interim period.
Wynn will serve while a search committee looks for Kennedy's permanent successor. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Politicians are known to talk about America's farmers and American soil to stir patriotic feelings. But nearly 30 million acres of U.S. farmland are held by foreign companies. That's a steep increase from just two decades ago, and it's a statistic that's ringing alarm bells in farm communities. Renee Wild reports for Harvest Public Media.
When the stock market tanked during the last recession, foreign investors began buying up big swaths of U.S. farmland. And because there are no federal restrictions on the amount of land that can be foreign-owned, it's been left up to individual states to decide on any limitations.
Texas is kind of a free-for-all, so they don't have a limit on how much land can be owned. You look at Iowa, and they restrict it. No land in Iowa is owned by a foreign entity.
Ty Higgins is with the Ohio Farm Bureau. Ohio, like Texas, also has no restrictions. And nearly 500,000 acres of prime farmland are held by foreign-owned entities. Companies from the Netherlands alone have purchased 64,000 acres for wind farms.
One of the main reasons that we're watching this type of issue is because once a foreign entity buys up, you know, however many acres they want, Americans might not ever be able to secure that land again. And so once we lose it, we may lose it for good.
Every acre of productive farmland that they convert over is an acre of land that no longer produces food. And since agriculture and food production contribute $20 million to Ohio's GSP, that loss is felt from the state level all the way down to rural communities. Angela Huffman is a sixth-generation farmer. This farm in the northern part of the state has been in her family for almost 200 years.
Right out my back door here, Chinese-owned Smithfield Foods, the largest pork producer in the world, has recently bought out a couple of grain elevators, basically extracting the wealth out of the community.
To be fair, U.S. farmers and corporations also invest in overseas agriculture, owning billions of dollars of farmland from Australia to Brazil. But the Smithfield food buyout has really raised concerns with American farmers. As part of that 2013 sale, a Chinese company now owns 146,000 acres of prime U.S. farmland.
The money that those elevators used to make, I stayed within the community. Today, the money those elevators make will go in the pockets of someone's thousands and thousands of miles away. Even those farmers that have buildings and are raising hogs for Smithfield, they really just become tenants on their own land. This is going on across America.
Joe Maxwell is a fourth-generation farmer from Missouri. He and Huffman are part of the Organization for Competitive Markets, an advocacy group of farmers and ranchers across the nation. He says Ohio will continue to see an influx of foreign investment as other states put restrictions in place.
So when they're looking for investments in the U.S. and agriculture, Ohio is a great ag state, and you don't have any restrictions like other states.
In the central part of the state, tractors are busy planting this year's crops. Nationwide, it's Canadian investors who own the most farmland. Here in Ohio, it's Germany, with 71,000 acres. John Trimmer manages 30,000 acres of corn and soybeans for German investors. He's been working with German families who want to get into U.S. agriculture since the 80s.
They started to buy land in Iowa and Minnesota, but right when they started then, they passed state laws which restricted foreign ownership.
Instead, they turned to Ohio. But Trimmer says there is a misconception about foreign owners, that they aren't good neighbors or good stewards of the land. What he sees is a growing divide between older family members who still live on the farm and their children who have no interest in the family business and want to cash out the land.
The last two farms we bought here through an owner, her and her brothers and sisters inherited it from their mother, and none of them want to farm, none of them have an interest in farm.
With a median age of U.S. farmers at 55, many face retirement with no prospect of family members willing to take over. The National Young Farmers Coalition anticipates that two-thirds of the nation's farmland will change hands in the next few decades. So, in states with no restrictions to cap foreign ownership, it's likely that lots more of it will end up in foreign hands. I'm Renee Wild in Ohio.
This report initially aired on NPR on Memorial Day. You can find more reports about farm and rural issues at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats.
Next time on The Pulse...
First and foremost, you make sure that you follow an excellent diet for the dogs.
Most pet owners spare no expense to keep their furry friends happy and healthy.
It sounds like Lucy's been doing pretty well at home.
I think so.
Yeah?
I mean, she's not losing any weight, even though she's on this restricted diet.
Cats and dogs and their health.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio, we have Sue Balcom.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Sue Balcom of the Root Cellars Farm joins us once a week to talk about food for Main Street Eats, and this week, you want to talk about edible flowers, and this is actually quite a lot of flowers.
Oh, it's amazing, but you know, April showers bring May flowers, and so... towards the end of the month or maybe June when you start planting your garden, you want to start thinking about planting some edible flowers because they add decoration to your plate and they're tasty and they're good for you. But we have some rules, always rules. You got to make sure if you're going to eat a flower that it is absolutely edible in the fact that you don't want it to be some kind of poison or a hallucinogenic. Like, I used to eat a lot of flowers just because they were out there in the weeds. Now I find out some of them I probably shouldn't have been eating. But
you apply the mushroom rule here.
Yeah,
if you don't know, don't eat
right,
it.
Right, yeah. If you're like me and you have, like, a really good immune system, it's probably okay. But, yeah, don't go out there and walk around like I used to do and eat flowers when you were kids. And they should be grown organically. Of course, we don't want pesticides on our flowers. And you should wash them in the event that they have a little road dust on them or there's sometimes tiny little bugs that hide them. And then don't eat any other parts but the petals or the blossom. And if you doubt what you're eating, then you just let it go. Oh, I remember now. It was the morning glories that grew around the wash line post at somebody's house, and I used to eat those on the way to school, and then I read you weren't supposed
morning
to eat
glories,
those.
Yes.
Morning
yes.
glories,
yeah,
yes.
They pulled those off the counters.
Yes, they did.
For a while. Ah, the good old days. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm lobbying to bring them back.
Of course.
Because you want to sign my petition? So, but the flowers you can eat now, help me out here, nasturtium.
Nasturtium.
Those
kind of
are
peppery tasting.
Yes, and you'll find these at a lot of fancy restaurants or when you go to conference dinners. This is kind of usually what you'll find on the plate because they are such beautifully colored flowers. And they're spicy, kind of like between a cross between watercress and radish. And we all love radishes.
Mm-hmm, I do.
And then, of course, rose petals. Not only do they smell nice and they make beautiful rose water to scent things, but you can actually eat the petals. And the darker the rose, the more pronounced the flavor.
Does this mean that as the rose ages and becomes less visually appealing, you can start to eat it? Or do you have to eat it fresh?
I think you want to eat them as fresh as possible, but I think they're talking about the light pink versus the dark red petals. Oh. Your dark red petals would be more fragrant and therefore probably have more flavor. And the little white part at the bottom of a rose petal is kind of bitter, so you maybe want to cut that off. And usually, you know, we're not talking about filling a bowl full of rose petals and gobbling them down, but as a garnish or maybe a palate cleaner whilst you're having a meal. And then there's, help me out.
Calendula?
Yes, you know, poor man's saffron. That's easier for me to say. So that's a yellow flower, of course, and that also has kind of a spicy, peppery tang to it. And then lots and lots of beautiful flowers. And sometimes, you know, if you have enough of it, it will tint your food yellow, which is kind of what saffron does when you add it to rice or something
like turmeric,
that.
Or turmeric, yeah.
Or turmeric, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, of course, everybody's favorite, daylilies, that grow like crazy and they grow along the sides of the roads. And if you're like me, you'll spread flower seeds out there and hope nobody sprays the ditch, and then you'll have lots to choose from when you're out foraging for stuff.
Well, how would you describe the daylily flavor?
Similar to asparagus.
Oh.
They have a vegetable, kind of vegetable flavors.
I did not see that coming.
But there are some lilies that are toxic, so you want to make absolutely sure that it's a daylily. And I will mention this again, and I have before. I've downloaded an app called Plant Snap, and you just take a photo of the blossom or a leaf, and it will tell you exactly what family, you know, the Latin name of your plant, and it will tell you what it is. And then that's one way you can identify a daylily from other lilies, because, you know, there's tiger lilies and there's wild lilies and all those kinds of things.
Mm. What can you do with squash blossoms, Sue?
Oh, my gosh. Squash blossoms can be dipped in an egg white and water. Pick them when they're just ready to open so that they're nice and fresh, and dip them in your egg batter and then fry them. And that's a really popular dish, fried squash blossoms.
Mm. Now, does lavender taste like it smells?
No, I do not think. It tastes more minty than it, you know, it smells sweeter,
it's
but tastes
very
mintier.
Very delicate, though.
Very delicate.
That's definitely one where you want it as fresh as possible. Well, that's probably almost always true. Or you need a lot.
Right, and it grows up here, but I killed mine off because I didn't protect it over the winter. So it is kind of a bit of a delicate to grow also, as well as flavor. What? But, you know, there's chives. Everybody grows chives, right, around the back of your house next to the rhubarb.
Whether you know it or not. I grow it in the supermarket. I didn't know they had flowers.
Oh, no. Yes, you know, you have. You've seen them once they bloom like an onion at the top.
Right.
They kind of have a little bunch of little teeny tiny little flowers up there. That's milder than the stem. And so you can, they're kind of like a light tasting onion. And they're pretty. Sometimes they're purple, sometimes they're white. But you can add those raw to salads and vinaigrettes. And it's just a nice, you know, our bodies are changing for seasonal eating, we're thinking lighter flavors. And then we'll get into the richer vegetables later on in the summer. And of course, you can always go out and eat dandelions. And you can eat echinacea, which is coneflower, which at one time was very, very popular for cold medicine.
Yeah.
Yes, and people were digging them up illegally off of private land, which I do not recommend. And you don't, anytime you harvest anything out in the wild or even from your garden, you don't want to over-harvest. because sometimes like echinacea needs its plants to reseed itself. And so if you kill it off, you're not doing yourself or anybody else any favors. So be considerate of that if you're going out and stealing off your neighbor's boulevard or something like that. But yes, echinacea, in addition to having it actually has anesthetic sort of properties in the roots. Like if you chew on, the Indians used to chew on the root when they had toothaches or something because it had like a Novocaine effect. But eating the petals, not the middle sticky part, but the petals will give you some healing properties also.
I've seen pansies and violets in restaurants on my plate.
But have you ever gotten down on your hands and knees and found them in your lawn?
No.
Because if you do not spray your lawn with chemicals, these things grow wild all over in our backyard. They're the teeny, tiny, teeny little plants, and they're purple and yellow. And they are beautiful, and you can dip them in a little egg white and sugar, and you can make sugared violets and put them on top of your cupcakes, and they're fresh and green and grassy tasting. And they're just a fun flower to go hunt. So get out there and look for some early violets and have yourself some flower garnishes.
Delightful.
It sounds delicious.
Colorful and light and flavorful. And as always, it's so much fun to eat.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys. I love it.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, the song asks the question, and every Thursday, Ashley Thornburg and I look at the calendar and try to answer it. And, of course, this is the first weekend in June coming up.
And it's my birthday. Is that enough of an event?
And it's my daughter's birthday, and her name is Ashley, too.
Hey,
imagine
June,
that.
June's for Ashley. Well, besides my birthday, Sketch a Horse experience this Saturday, June 1st in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. So master artist Kim Esslinger is going to be helping people, kids, adults. Kids have to have chaperones to learn how to draw, and specifically horses. They're absolutely beautiful creatures. This event is from 1 to 2:30 on Saturday, and it's free at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum.
The NDSU Chamber Festival is this evening in Fargo at the university's Beckwith Recital Hall on campus. You can enjoy intimate and exhilarating encounters with great chamber music performed by top-notch musicians paired with NDSU student pianists. The fifth anniversary season features the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra, concertmaster Sonia Harasim, as well as the much-anticipated return of cellist Colin Carr, a globe-trotting soloist, chamber music A-lister, and faculty member of the Royal Conservatory of London Musicians. So lots of really great musicians and great music this evening in Fargo at NDSU's Beckwith Recital Hall for the NDSU Chamber Festival. It starts at 7:30, and get this, it's free.
There is a fishing derby this weekend on June 1st in Dickinson at Turtle Park, and this is for kids. So kids 12 and under are eligible to fish here. There's going to be trophies for the largest fish in each of the different age groups. Kids are going to be treated to a free hot dog lunch and maybe even some door prizes. 8 a.m. to noon on Saturday the 1st in Dickinson at Turtle Park, and it's free, and even kids don't need to worry about getting a fishing license for this particular event.
Well, while we're talking about water, it is that season, so people should be aware of water safety, and there will be a community water safety day Friday in Bismarck at the Missouri Valley Family YMCA. You can check out that new Family Splash Center at the Y. Visit safety stations from various community organizations, including the Bismarck Police Department and the Burley Morton Rescue Team. You can participate in activities and collect prizes, see demonstrations, and learn about water safety throughout the event. It runs from 4 to 7 on Friday in Bismarck, again at the Missouri Valley Family YMCA with that brand new Family Splash Center. And it is priced right. It's free.
Also this Saturday, Tabletop Day, International Tabletop Day at that. And you can celebrate in Grand Forks at the library. So if you are a fan of Risk or Monopoly, checkers, chess, even cribbage, and so many other board games out there. These are some classics. But boy, go to a game shop and you will see that that is really making a comeback. So Saturday, June 1st in Grand Forks at the Public Library, celebrate International Tabletop Day, 10 to 10, and it's free.
Well, Rooftop Yoga and Mimosas is Sunday in Fargo at Downtown Yoga. Rooftop Yoga and Mimosas, interesting combination, is back for its second summer. And the warm weather, of course, makes that a lot more pleasant. So you can join them on the rooftop patio overlooking Rocco Alley as they offer mimosas and do yoga. If you've never tried yoga before, this is the perfect low-key class where you'll get in a workout and enjoy doing it and, of course, have a beverage on the way. Come with friends or meet some awesome new ones. Either way, you'll experience yoga in a completely different way. It runs from noon until 1 in the afternoon on Sunday in Fargo in Downtown Yoga. That's the name of the business. The cost is $15.
Well, I sure hope they do the mimosas after the rooftop yoga, because that seems like it could be quite a combination here. Escape the Library, Tuesday, June 4th in Fargo, and this is at the Downtown Library. So you've heard of these escape rooms where you go in and usually you have to solve some sort of puzzle with teamwork, and then you get a clue, and it's kind of like a scavenger hunt, and you've got to figure out how to get out of the room. Well, they're bringing that to the library, and you can participate at 1, 2, or 3 o'clock on Tuesday the 4th, again at the Downtown Fargo Library, and it's free, but they would like you to give them a call and register for a time slot.
All right. Well, I think it's time for you to pick a favorite this week.
Okay. We started with horse drawing.
You
and
did.
Now there's going to be a horse expo. Clearly, I want a pony for my birthday, but it's never going to happen. Friday the 31st in Minot at the North Dakota State Fair Center. This is a horse expo designed to benefit the Boys and Girls Ranch Club of Minot and specifically their equine therapy program. So we had someone on the show yesterday talking about how important horses are and in a lot of different therapy programs. And this is a program in Minot, and you can see this horse expo at the State Fair Center on Friday the 31st, 9 to 9, and tickets are just $10. And go and look at these beautiful and important animals.
My pick is the Street Fair at the Lakes. Now, when I was a kid growing up in Detroit Lakes, the big event of the summer was the Northwest Water Carnival. That takes place in late summer, and that started in the mid-1930s. This is something a bit newer. Street Fair at the Lakes runs Friday through Saturday. It's in downtown Detroit Lakes. It's that time of the year for their annual street fair. You can enjoy the first juried art show of the season. You know, there will be food, of course, street food. And you can check out this year's giant beer garden, which seems to go with everybody's street fair these days. There will also be live music in the area and lots of free entertainment for the kids. It runs from 10 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, again, both days, Friday and Saturday. It's free to attend, but there will be stuff for sale because it is a street fair, and that's what's happening.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about a grim subject. We talk with President Jefferson about suicide.
Well, three in particular. One is that Meriwether Lewis, his protege, almost certainly committed suicide in October of 1809. James Hemings, one of his most important slaves, he eventually freed, and Hemings committed suicide in Baltimore. And then finally, there is the question that nobody can really answer. what happened to Alexander Hamilton on the dueling grounds at Weehawken in July of 1804.
And President Jefferson actually opens up a bit about his own personal depression surrounding the loss of his wife, Martha.
She died in September of 1782, and Jefferson had effectively a nervous breakdown and wrote to his sister-in-law saying it wasn't clear that he would go on if he weren't the father of young, surviving children.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 30th. St. Mary's, Fargo's Catholic Cathedral, wasn't yet completed when hundreds of visitors and many priests gathered to dedicate the structure. People came from all over North Dakota, arriving by train in time for the 10 a.m. event, which took place on this date in 1899. There was also high-level Catholic clergy from Winnipeg, St. Paul, and Philadelphia. The event was doubly special for Bishop John Shanley, who was marking the 25th anniversary of his ordination that day. He led a march of priests and altar boys, sprinkling holy water on the new cathedral as the procession circled the structure. But the building wasn't quite completed. Through a slight hitch, according to the local newspaper, the large window on the cathedral's north side was late to be installed, and work on the 172-foot tower wasn't completed yet either. But the ceremony went on nonetheless. After the procession, the crowd of onlookers entered the building, where the dedication ceremony continued, followed by Mass. Shanley had begun planning for the cathedral when he arrived in the early 1890s. Construction only got as far as the basement before the Great Fargo Fire of 1893, which destroyed most of downtown. Building the cathedral was further delayed when Shanley donated funds he had raised for the project to the city for reconstruction of the town. The Victorian Gothic building is located at 619 7th Street North in Fargo. It's not the only architectural masterpiece in the neighborhood. The First Presbyterian Church at 2nd Avenue and Robert Street is a stone Scottish Gothic Revival church with intricate stained glass windows. It was dedicated in 1930, 31 years after St. Mary's. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In competitive sports, women and men are placed in separate categories. But a recent court ruling raises questions about fairness, ethics, and who should be allowed to compete as a woman.
People think that it's simple to define sex. It's not.
Plus more from our opening argument series with 2020 candidate and Washington Governor Jay Inslee on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hold our monthly editor's roundtable discussion of topics in the news. In addition to Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, we'll have special guests Jim Shaw, a former television news director who writes a newspaper column, and Renee Jean, Assistant Managing Editor of the Williston Herald. And Matt Olean will review the new Olivia Wilde-directed movie, Booksmart. Hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.